Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times with me, Aidan Williams, as we venture into the centre circle once again to discuss another fabulous book with another fascinating author, and we're getting all historical this time. But before we get to all that, here to test their football history knowledge with me are two of our usual suspects. Looking fearful already there, Stu. How are you doing there, Stu Horsfield?
Good. It was when you threw the word testing. That was never in the script that you sent out.
It's not in the script, but, you know, it's an education always, so why not have a bit of a test of your credentials? There's no actual test, Stu.
I should have brought a black biro and a see-through pencil case and taken my watch off at the door. Good. Very excited for this. Great book. And obviously, as we know, sort of our passion for the history of the game is something that we all love, and this is exactly what this is going to be.
Exactly. So don't be worried. we'll just realize at the end that you haven't been paying attention.
And that's I was always the naughty kid in class. I was always the kid who talked too much.
Says the current college lecturer. But there we go. Uh-huh. Also with us is Stephen Scragg. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm all right. I've got all the answers etched onto my water bottle, and I'm ready to roll.
Can I sit next to you? Can I move down the screen?
But yes, looking forward to this one.
So we're here to talk.
Sorry, I'm just saying. Massively looking forward to this one. This is a bit like when we got Will onto the Arsenal podcast. This feels like, you know, something. Something a bit special. Not that everyone else isn't special, but this is a bit special.
Well, exactly. And this is a very specific theme. And I think it's safe to say the hours of dedication and research that have gone into this book say a lot about the author and the dedication of it. So we're here to talk about the book Origin Stories, The Pioneers Who Took Football to the World, with the excellent Chris Lee, who many listeners may know from his football travel and culture podcast, The Outside Right. Evening there, Chris. How are you doing?
Hi, Aidan. Hi, guys. How are you going?
Very, very good. Well, looking forward to this. I mean, just on that point initially mentioned there about the hours of dedication and research, I mean, just how much effort and time has gone into this book?
I think it was about 4 years in the end. So obviously I had to juggle like full-time work with it as well. So it's a question of like finding the time, writing on trains, writing on planes, and reading a lot, visiting the odd museum, and putting it all together. Then it's almost like the editing took as long as the writing, really.
So at least you've got to go on trips and all that, you know, it's proper research. This is fun research, not just the painstaking stuff. So that's all good. But to start things off then, Chris, do you want to give us all a bit of an intro to the book in general, which was released earlier this year, I should point out, and what it's all about?
Yeah, brilliant. Well, firstly, thanks for having me on. You've all been on mine, which is pretty good to be able to sort of reciprocate and come on here and talk to you guys. Yeah, it's called Origin Stories of Pioneers Who Took Football to the World. It came out by Pitch Publishing in April 2021. It seems to be doing quite well. It's getting good reviews on Amazon so far. And it's basically a country-by-country story of how football got started in all the major footballing countries or regions. It's pretty much everywhere. In a rough chronological order. So we're going from very first kick, as in, you know, who came along and set up a pitch and also jumpers for goalpost type thing. And then right up to 1930 World Cup, by which time you pretty much say it's been played everywhere, there are leagues everywhere, there's even professionalism coming in a lot of countries. And therefore it's kind of like a global game, you know? So I thought the inspiration behind it is I think I spoke to Sheffield FC, which is obviously widely recognised, as sure you guys know, as like the world's oldest, I suppose, first football club. And we'll go into them in a minute, I'm sure. But I went up to a game that they did every pre-season. So I interviewed them. I thought, I'm going to have a look. at this up in Sheffield at this pre-season friendly called the Rules Derby, which is them against Hallam FC, also of Sheffield, who is second oldest club in the world, formed 1860. So they played on Boxing Day 1860. Obviously, it's 3 years before the FA was founded. And so they were playing by Sheffield rules, which I'm sure we'll come to as well, because the rules at this time of football were kind of all over the place. There's lots of different interpretations. And they've been playing this, like, you know, 147th fixture, whatever it was, of this particular game. And I thought, actually, I've got something sort of genesis for an idea here, because I looked into what the oldest clubs were. I'd already been to Genoa, I'd already been to Antwerp. You know, these are the oldest clubs in those respective, sort of in Italy and Belgium, respectively. And I thought, you know what, what would be good is, if you look at, like, you know, books, there's country by country books, really. So they think about, like, Morbo for Spain, Tor for Germany, Angel with Dirty Faces for Argentina, Calcio for Italy. Yeah, they all focus on one country's entire story. And quite often the sort of like the roots of the game is kind of condensed in the beginning. And I thought it'd be interesting to know, like, every single country. Some countries haven't been covered in this regard, France being one of them in English anyway. Really, really, really significant country, been often overlooked. We've got, like, you know, the Scandinavian countries haven't really been covered early. Their roots, Switzerland, Netherlands, in English this is, and various other places. I thought, well, it'd be worth looking into those, understanding a bit more about that. Who was it that brought it in? How? What did they play? And I sort of, again, needed to differentiate, because obviously you've got these, some of these books covering well-covered stories that people know already. So it's like, what can I do that brings a different perspective? And I'm thinking often, because the game is coming out of Britain at the time, it's often English or Scots who are taking this elsewhere, or, well, there's two ways really, is either British expats are taking it out, or it's like people have come and studied in England or Scotland and gone back to their home country and took it with them. And I just thought, well, let's have a sort of, you know, British perspective of what's happening in the world, to taking this game and seeing how it's developing. So over this 50-year period, roughly, you see kind of obviously these countries get better and obviously supersede the home nation, so to speak, by 1930. And although, of course, England and Scotland didn't go to the World Cup, so we'll never fully know. But the I just thought, like, let's see what challenges they faced, and, you know, who drove it, who are the personalities behind it, who are the sponsors. And there's some famous people from history that might surprise a few people. And there's some great stories along the way. Obviously, it's linked to class, it's linked to race, it's linked to, you know, national awakening. And there's loads of stories in there that came out of this kind of 4 years of research. I got to speak to descendants of founders, descendants of players, you know, someone who his great grandfather, I think, had played in the very first fixture in Portugal, someone whose grandfather had played in the 1930 World Cup, someone whose great-great-grandfather, I think it was, had founded the first team in Spain. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, like, fascinating. And it was a really interesting journey to do that. So, and I got a lot of access. And so, it's an absolute journey.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you talk there of English origins, and I guess this is where it all began for you. The Sheffield Derby, Sheffield FC against Hallam, that you went to. Now, you mentioned there the Sheffield rules and so on, and this is one interesting aspect that obviously comes through in the development of the early days of the game before association rules really took hold and became embedded. So there's Sheffield rules, there's presumably Eton rules, there was rugby rules, and obviously that went off in a different direction, and, yeah, and various other rules. So what were these differences in terms of how it was played? I know you go into it in the book, but in terms of some of the key things that we probably wouldn't even recognize as football.
Well, the book starts
counted as football in those days.
Well, exactly. I mean, everything's football. And this is the thing, this is what I have to be really careful about, nuance, because I lived and played soccer in Australia, in the state of Victoria, in Melbourne. And there, football is Australian rules, which kind of actually were down on paper before the FA rules were, by a few years. And if you go next door to New South Wales, it's football is rugby league. And if you go across the Tasman Sea to New Zealand, football is rugby union. If you fly off to America, it's obviously gridiron or the NFL. And then if you come over to Ireland, it's Gaelic football. So this is where, you know, the word soccer comes in handy, obviously, as an abbreviation of of association football by Charles Wilfred Brown, the famous Corinthian player. Not an Americanism, as I'm kind of keen to emphasize in the book. Very English word, and soccer is very useful to use as a term. But it does go to show, like you're saying, there's so many different types of rules at this time that were going around. The rugby rules, obviously, were very famously so, all to do with contact. And if you look at the game of what we now know as football, soccer, in the 1860s, it was actually wasn't that massively kind of different to some of the other kicking games. You still had, like, you could take a mark like you can in Australian rules or rugby. You had, like, touchdowns, as you have in American football. Oh, they had things called rouges as well, which came from one of the public schools. They had their own, like you said, and the whole idea of the fact that whenever someone left Charterhouse School or they left Harrow or they left and they went to Cambridge University and they wanted to play each other, it's like they couldn't agree which rules to play. And this is incredible, given that football is so ancient. I think the oldest football is still in existence is in Stirling Castle. I think it's like 16th century. And there's actually, like, you know, mob football that's still recreated elsewhere. And I go to one near me in Kent every Easter. And it's like, and they kind of discharge ball between two pubs that is like a mile apart. And it's kind of, that's classed as football because it was folk football. And it's actually took, I can't believe it took this long until 1863 to actually get some people around the table and say, look, let's have a consensus and start a, you know, form an actual rule book that everyone would play the same rules against each other. So we're not arguing about the size of the pitch, the size of the goals, how many, you know, who's, how do you score, how do you tackle, whether you can handle or not. And so that's kind of what happened on the 26th of October, 1863. And then for anyone who's going off Great Queen Street off of Kingsway and Holborn in London's West End, if you go there, you'll see the plaque just on the side where the Freemasons Tavern once stood, and that's where the various clubs got together and met to found the Football Association in October 1863. And over the course of several meetings, during which time a lot of the private schools disappeared and decided to sort of stick to rugby, and then Rugby Football Union was formed about a decade later. I think 1871, which is about 8 years later. And then, they basically, the rules of the Football Association were put down, printed by Mr. John Lillywhite, I think it was name was, and away you go. That's how it all started, really.
Now, there's a whole range of stories from across the globe in this book of the development. You know, some a bit familiar, many less so. I mean, these tales are the incredibly deep detail they go into. I guess they go a long way, Stu, into understanding how things are today, not just from the sporting or footballing perspective, but socially as well. You're in talk of the development there of how the game's evolved, and, you know, the gentleman class and then the workers. It's a social history, it's not just of this country too, you know, it's development in all sorts of countries have that aspect to it, don't they, which adds a whole layer of fascination.
It does, and people who listen to this podcast regularly will know that the next sentence that's about to fall out my mouth, and that is how football reflects society and society reflects football. And it's done that for as long as the game has been in existence. You know, it's, you can go to any country, or you can watch a game, or you can watch a game of football or talk to somebody about football from that country, and you can get a real understanding of the culture, the current societal ills, the current societal enjoyment, what it means to be from that country, and all of that is reflected in the game. And I think it's you know, people talk about, you know, it's the game of the people, and yes, you know, originally it starts off with the middle class, it starts off with the public schools, but once it becomes taken almost by the working class, from there on in, it will always have that almost further and deeper embedding into the culture and into the society of wherever that game is played. And obviously, as we know, the game is such a simple game, and, you know, and Chris has talked about the rules and the development of the rules, but the beauty of football is because it's such a simple game with such little equipment needed to essentially play the game, it can be played by anybody anywhere, and so its popularity just explodes. And so it, to me, and Chris's book does this really, really well, because there are sort of well-known you know, like we said, the well-known stories of some of the South American countries, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, England, Scotland. But then, you know, Chris's book takes us right around the world, and it sort of informs us of how the game becomes embedded and how the game becomes entrenched. But then from there, how it fully immerses itself and almost molds itself. It reminds me of going back to films, Terminator 2. The liquid metal, it's sort of the way that just molds itself to any form that it needs to be. To me, that's what football did. It was an entity, almost this alien entity, that just immerses itself in society. And then once it's in, it spreads and touches every part of society. That's how I see it. It's a lot like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, the interesting thing is that actually it starts, like you said, it starts with the public school game. It's the famous 1883 Cup final where you finally see Blackburn Olympic overturn the old Etonians, and that's where the part of the change. And partly of that because the 1874 Factory Act and working men, predominantly, I should say, got Saturday afternoon off to play and watch football. And that's, like I said, that changed. But it wasn't everywhere. Everywhere, usually, like I mentioned before, when it's like students that came to UK and went back to their own country to try and play and set up the game there. They it was because they had the means and the money, and then there was all the gentlemen squires as well at that point. So it's kind of like it started off almost everywhere, started as a an exclusive game, and sort of then, like I said, distilled further down the social order, shall we say, democratized.
Well, I mean, speaking of the social order, rugby obviously saw a split between the northern professionals and the gentlemen amateurs, which formalized into two distinct codes of the game, or in fact two separate sports, I guess, in the end. But it's really interesting, and it comes through in the book, to consider how close football came to a similar split. Stephen, it goes into quite a bit of detail of this, obviously, in the first couple of chapters on England and Scotland. Do you think this was great vision and foresight, or was this simply good fortune that football avoided a similar split?
I just think good fortune more than anything else. You know, it's one of those great what ifs. But yeah, I think there's a lot of I don't know, fate at play, and you know, it's just certain decisions. I always say with anything to do with football, and it's the same with life, is that there are never kind of like a big epiphany as such. You know, the end result tends to be deflected by many variables to its final resting point. But even with football, there's never quite a final resting point, because you know it goes again from August, and something else happens. You know, so. Yeah, I think as much by chance as by design that football avoided, you know, the fate of rugby, you know, and you know, even further back, you know, you look at some of those, you know, formative versions of football, and how now that they still sound like, I don't know, those odd kind of English games that are poked fun at on Channel 5 programmes. Like shin kicking and rolling cheeses down hills and you know, and all that type of stuff, and you know but for the grace of God, that was football. You know, people would look at us very, very oddly. You know, the whole, I don't know, this passion that football has become could be something completely different. You know, as Chris said, it could have been rugby, it could have been the handling game that we were all talking about now, and we'd all be looking askance at kind of like, you know, this oddity of trying to kind of like kick a ball three miles across the field. Or I mean, I always remember watching footage of, I think it was one like the story of John Barnes video or something like that, and he took part in playing the Eton Wall game, where you've got to hit kind of like a gate that's partway up a wall and stuff like that. No one had scored for hundreds of years in this game and all of that, and that was football's possible fate. You know, had it not been for these, like you say, a certain amount of variables that deflect it into a completely different stratosphere.
Well, the key figure in all that is Charles W. Alcock, who is at the foundation of the FA with his team, which came Wanderers, the first FA Cup winners. He invents the FA Cup. He invites people to play for this Challenge Cup, which is based on the knockout tournament he played at Harrow, where he was at school. he also is pivotal in the professionism debate in the mid-1880s. Sees which way the wind is blowing, learns from cricket, that you can have shamateurism if you're not careful, you might as well be open about it. And it's been going on, as you know, for like years anyway, which is kind of covered in Netflix English, The English Game, which came out, I think it was just at the beginning of the first lockdown, was it March last year or something like that? It was around then, because I remember watching it just at the point I was sort of wrapping up the text. I thought, oh no, am I going to find something else here? But it's interesting that that part of history has been examined again, but I think he's absolutely pivotal in taking it in that particular direction. And while rugby, you could argue, sort of stood still, like I said, and they had their own split in 1890s, because if that hadn't happened, the Lancashire clubs would have gone their own way anyway. And like I said, you could have lots of different types of football kicking around.
Just imagine, yes, as Stephen said, how different it would have all been if it just been the little oddity of Northern England or Southern England with different variations. But instead, it did spread across Europe and the world. So how that happened is really interesting too. I think, you know, the book covers this really well, of course, but, you know, as well as the role of development of the game, not only in the better known stories like the Danubian schools of Vienna, Budapest, Prague, and so on, but then you mentioned the often overlooked French influence on the development in Europe and Switzerland too. Less well known, but significant nonetheless. And, why is that overlooked? I mean, I guess that's a question there. Why is France's input into how the game has developed and spread not as well known? Is it purely a case of timing, you know, that Danubian football came along when things were getting a bit more global?
It could be the book goes England first, then goes Scotland next, even though Queen's Park was 1867, so 3 years after Wrexham in Wales, but Scotland, because of Scotland's role, I kind of obviously brought it up to the second chapter. And you know, then Queen's Park is one of these evangelist clubs that takes it abroad. They play in Copenhagen, they play in Belfast, Clapton plays in Belgium, and lots of clubs come to the southeast are going over there as well. It's one of these British expat stories in Love in France, where they're playing a kind of combination game because they're from Oxford and Cambridge. Goes back to a similar thing we were saying before, and that's why Love Athletic Club nowadays play in light blue and dark blue halves. It's because they're Oxford and Cambridge, and actually have the club hymn is the club anthem is Le Ciel et Marine, which is like the light blue and sea blue, dark blue, whatever it is, and it's set to God Save the Queen as a tune. So it's quite interesting because they're very into their sort of like the Oxford and Cambridge heritage there. But obviously they kind of weigh out, and it's like in Paris where it all sort of starts in the 1880s, 1890s, among this sort of expat community there. And there's some really interesting clubs there. And it's at this point it becomes kind of Paris is hosting the Olympics in the 1900, and Pierre de Coubertin, who's the guy who reinvents resurrects the modern Olympics, brings it in. And it's only like, because it has to be amateur, by which time obviously the English clubs are professional. So the Team GB, a team for that, is Upton Park of East London, playing against a team of Brussels students and a French kind of athletics association team, mostly picked, I think, from Racing Club, if I'm not mistaken. So it's like Upton Park wins the gold for GP. But in that regard, it's interesting that the French, obviously behind the Olympics, which is the first international competition, and that's 1900. 1904, you have the foundation of FIFA by Robert Guérin, a journalist who also coached the French team. You've got Jules Rimet, who of course founded the World Cup, and Henri Delaunay, who's kind of also significant there. He founded the European Nations Cup later on. And as you know, Stephen, from your book, because we conversed about this, L'Équipe, a member of L'Équipe, was behind the foundation of the European Cup. So they've all these trophies, all these like competitions are founded by Frenchmen. And it's kind of significant. They gave this kind of international order and standing repute to the game. And yet, like you said, it's often overlooked. I don't know if because in France it isn't as big a sport. I think maybe cycling was bigger. France itself wasn't I say that good at football, I didn't win a trophy till 1984, which is very, very late. In that regard, I know they sort of made up for lost time now with 2 Euros, 2 World Cups. But their club sides haven't performed very well in European competition. So it's maybe is that France as a standing doesn't have the same, I don't know, international repute. I don't know. What do you guys think?
To me, like I say, to me, it's a great question that Aidan asked. It's, I suppose, to the layman, even to myself, there's just almost this assumption that, you know, football, it's the UK and it sort of spreads into Europe and you go, yep, they took it on. And this is probably quite imperialistic by me. I apologise, I'm quite colonial. And then you go, yep, and then it went to South America and that's great and it did that. But it's, you never, oh, I certainly didn't, and certainly wasn't until this book, you know, and you sort of think, well, actually, yeah, you know, these are all standalone nations. And as we mentioned before, they all have their own unique culture, their own unique society at the time. You know, Aidan's talked about the Danubian and the coffee houses and looking at football almost as a combination of a branch of science and art. And, you know, and it seems that some countries, their development really caught the imagination. And in others, it's just a blasé, well, yeah, they played it. And it's just an assumption that's made. You don't, or I certainly didn't, really go in or think about the minute detail of nationalistic culture and how they would adopt a game that is played by everybody. And I think that's the beauty of this book, is that it reminds you that each nation is obviously different, and how they adapted the game is slightly different and has its own quirks. I've clearly not answered your question. I've no idea why.
But what you did mention there, Stu, is colonial, and that's where football ends up differing from some of the other English or British exports like rugby and cricket, is obviously a lot of the countries they're popular in are former colonies. It's the empire. It's the gentleman officer class, I think, that spread those games, because they're the public schoolboy games as it ended up, and football became more of the masses, as we talked about. So it doesn't develop that way. It develops, as you said, Stu, more like permeating everywhere, like Arnie.
It does, like the T2000.
Oh, not Arnie. Arnie's enemy, wasn't it? Yeah. It's the other guy. It's the other guy. But yeah, it gets everywhere, and that's through trade rather than empire. When that's another fascinating aspect to it all, I think.
It is, but like I say, it's fascinating that until you really read this book, some countries you really buy into as to how they absorb the game and, as we say, how it permeated. In other countries, you just go, yeah, it just...
But one of those other countries, it isn't very glamorous, is Switzerland. And I know that's because I think it's the shortest chapter. But however, they are kind of like the first new wave after England to go and form clubs. I guess the proximity to Italy helps, and Italy's a very late starter. That's why it's near the end of the book. But, you know, the Swiss are behind the foundation of Torino, Bari, Inter, Barcelona, and even as far as Fluminense in Rio. So, you know, these, and obviously now they're the home of all the various organizations. That's kind of one that just came by one of the catches. I didn't think people would be that invested in that one, but I want to just highlight that is like, you know, the Swiss were really important.
So I think I'll just jump in there and go back to France as well, is that I think a lot of us see them as the great administrators, the great organisers of the game, rather than the great players of the game. And that's mad, considering that they've gone on to win a couple of World Cups and a couple of European Championships in more contemporary times. But like Chris said, the first, you know, success comes in the 1980s. They've all come during the colour television era. So there's almost kind of like, I think we associate passion to football, and maybe French passions have been, you know, traditionally channeled in other directions, whether that's music, food, you know, human love or whatever it is, you know, the various French games. But, you know, football took a bit of time to bed in, you know. I think that's a great thing. But say that they were in from the start as far as kind of like the organisation, very, very keen on organising the game and wanted, you know, organised tournaments that encompassed and rolled over no borders. And you know, it is mad that, you know, France is given such kind of short shrift, but then rolling into Switzerland, which is just next door. And I have a fascination for that chap, because, you know, Switzerland's a part of the world that I've visited a good few times. You know, our holidays tend to be in France, not far from the Swiss border. You know, seeing the references of Geneva and Lausanne, you know, brought a smile to the face, because it's such a familiar part of the world for me. And yeah, you know, it's the way that, you know, again, it's almost like working like stepping stones as such. You know, as Stu said before, football tends to kind of like permeate from one direction to another. And yeah, there's a sort of T2 about it, but there's also a bit of Japanese knotweed in there as well. You know, once it takes hold, it's got to travel and travel fast.
That's one way to look at it. Yeah.
That is indeed one way to look at it. Well, somewhere it very much took hold is South America, of course. Now, Stu, Stephen, both of you, you've done a whole series or a couple of series discussing football in South America, you know, its development, its culture, and so on. Now, what stands out to me, as well as how it's, you know, taken over there, is a few of the sort of key characters, the pioneers from this country who were key to South American development. It almost seems, in some cases, a little bit by chance or just certain circumstance that's seen that certain characters lead to provide the spark to ignite the game in places like Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and so on, and beyond eventually. This, of course, has led to some extremely English-sounding club names in South America. You've got Racing Club, or Racing, I suppose they'd say, Newell's, Old Boys, Wanderers, Everton, Liverpool, Corinthians, of course.
Yeah.
The history of the development in South America and where it's come from is kind of writ large and preserved through these clubs, the key names and the characters involved, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's been quite well covered, or at least Argentina and Brazil have been. That's why the Uruguay chapter for me was the most interesting one. And obviously, wherever I can, I speak to someone local to get the viewpoint on that. But as you said, yeah, it's often the first wave, it's the expats who are there for usually for commerce. They've brought their families, they've got children, therefore they have schools. So they've got like schools for both British and sort of, you know, mixed Anglo-Argentinian families. Anglo-Uruguayan families, and both time, and also Brazil, obviously the exclusive community, again, Brazil a little bit later, but it really takes hold very early on in the River Plate. And as I speak to one of the top historians down there, that rivalry between those two countries, because they're so close together, their accents are very similar. It's very, they need that, so they always inspire each other. And that's, what I think it's no surprise that Uruguay is like the first non-European international superpower, and Argentina's just behind it, frustratingly so, as you know, in the 20s, they came in the 30s. You know, I think their first clubs are coming in sort of, you know, early 1890s. I think Argentina has a league in 1891. It's all expats, mostly Scots, in the Buenos Aires area that found that. And it starts again in the 1893. So it's the first sort of league outside of UK and Ireland actually, you know, playing football. And there's a history going back to kind of 20 years prior to that, where they've been playing exhibition games amongst the sort of expat community. Anyway, so people, the locals have been exposed to this. They see, as you know, the Locos Ingleses, the mad English. And again, apologies to other kind of British listeners here, is that the quite often English and British get mixed up by some countries. So you have to be keen to say it's both English and Scots, typically, who were introducing the game into Argentina and Uruguay. And so, yeah, a lot, then, of course, some of it's from school. So we see Isaac Newell founds a school in Rosario. So he's in the north while this league is going on in Buenos Aires. So separately, entirely, he's teaching the game to his school. And when they leave, they want to keep playing. So they become Newell's Old Boys. And Claudio is one of the co-founders of that. And he was from Rochester in Kent, which is just up the road from me. So they're my time in Argentina as a result. And then you've got another guy from Bromley, he's not far from me as well, where I grew up. He was behind Albion football club in Montevideo. So it's the first longest surviving team still existing in Montevideo. And the team, obviously they're coming out of often coming out of railway organizations. So you've got a couple in Argentina, as you'd know, that was now Rosario Central, that came out of a railway team. Ferrocarril Oeste, which is the Western Railway in Buenos Aires. And in Montevideo, they've got the Central Uruguayan Railway Cricket Club, which goes on to become Peñarol, which is the team of the century in the 20th century eventually. And they wear yellow and black because of, as a nod to Stevenson's Rocket, which is the world's first train. So they've kind of had this sort of railway heritage. But the interesting thing was what the transition from CURC, as they were called, the Central Uruguayan Railway Cricket Club, and to Peñarol, you see this, it basically symbolizes for me the changeover of kind of Anglo-South American influence to kind of what's known as criollo, the local sort of mixed population, usually of Spanish and Italian descent, who take it on, give it their flavor. And you see, it's interesting, you see the games between Argentina and Uruguay, or Argentinian teams and Uruguayan teams in the 20th century, so the 1900s, you see they still got, the Argentinians still have sort of Anglo names, and the Uruguayans have got a more Spanish, Basque and Italian sort of surnames. And you can see this changeover happening as the sort of British community kind of, I guess, declines in influence and the locals kind of take over, I suppose. And it's kind of, this is indicative when CURC becomes Peñarol, which is the district of Montevideo. It's named after Club Atlético Peñarol, and that is in 1913, I think. And also they have a rival with Nacional, as you know. Nacional is like the first kind of criollo form club in Uruguay. And they're interesting as well in their own right. I did a blog post about this, the most 11 clubs that changed their course of history. And I included Nacional in there because they are, not only were they the first kind of locally founded club in South America, so they're kind of the first of the new generation, effectively, that's not Anglo influenced. But also they had a hinchador, a guy who used to inflate the puffer, his name, he used to blow the balls up. I can't remember his name, something Reyes, but he is basically why South American and Spain fans are called hinchas, because of him, basically, like the puffer. So he's kind of like quite a character, and he's like invented, I guess, football fandom in South America, that, you know, that unique flavor that's he's like the genesis of all that followed. So they're quite interesting from that point of view. Yeah, I mean, it's just a fascinating evolution, which I think I've caught there, and leads, obviously, the Uruguay chapter from this sort of the Anglo influence right through to winning two Olympics, 24 and 28, both away from home, long way from home, in fact, in Paris and Amsterdam. And then as a result of their success, they are awarded the first World Cup to host it in 1930. They struggle to get many Europeans to take part, as only four countries that do. And I start with a letter from someone who, an English guy who's writing, working for the Argentinian Railways, and he's like really angry that England hasn't gone down and played these River Plate teams, because they're selling the club scenes. You know, the club teams have been going since Southampton in the early 1900s, and Corinthians obviously went to Brazil. You know, Exeter played Brazil as famously in their first international. Plymouth Argyle have gone, you know, other teams have gone. Everton, as you know, because obviously they're named after a team in Valparaiso near Santiago in Chile. And they're going, well, why won't England, or you know, or Scotland for that matter, play these national sides to see where they really stand against the world's, what was definitively the world's best, because Uruguay won all the trophies that were out there at that time. And England and Scotland wouldn't play them. So there we are. That's how we open the chapter, because I just, it's really interesting. Had England and Scotland entered those early tournaments, they may have more in the trophy cabinet than they do. So
they may well do. I know. It's interesting to contemplate how course of history could have been different there, Stu, isn't it? You know, there's the way it's all developing. I mean, Corinthians got a mention there. Obviously, the English version of Corinthians. More than just a paragon of sporting virtue and gentlemanly fair play. They come into the book, obviously, as they're pretty much every chapter, aren't they? You know, chapter, Corinthians taught here in 1908 and Corinthians taught here in 1910. They're everywhere, Stuart, aren't they?
They are. And I think it's funny because, like you say, I think it's Corinthians who would intentionally miss penalties as it was deemed an ungentlemanly way to score. And it's funny, I mean, you look at football now and you look at the win at all costs. Obviously, you know, money's become involved, and that's the thing that is completely different between Corinthians then and football now. But you look at what teams, players, managers are prepared to do to win, and you look back then at what teams were prepared to do to not score. You know, it's a real dichotomy. But yeah, that Corinthian ideal. Part of me wishes more of it still existed. Part of me wishes that, you know, that it was still referred back to. It obviously was, you know, with the advent of professionalism, it's only a matter of time once money gets involved that these things change. But again, I think, you know, I know I keep going back to the same sort of thing, but football, with it being so simple, is such a blank canvas that it can be so impressionable that, you know, whether it's South America and, you know, the fans, you know, South American fans are so different to English fans, who are so different to maybe Asian fans. But that's because football is such a blank canvas, which is part of the beauty of it. It can just be imprinted upon so easily by whether it's administrators, by whether it's fans, by whether it's ideals, by whether it's professional leagues. And like I say, this, you know, the tour in the, you know, that almost not, I mean, obviously it's, you know, it's after, if you think about it, after World War One, and, you know, and the world went through this unbelievably traumatic event, you know, and it was the war to end all wars. And as we know, it wasn't, but what it shows you there is how sport has the power to unify nations. It has the power to tear nations apart as well, if you want to think about Uruguay and Argentina at that time. But it also had the power to unify. And those early touring teams were sort of pioneers almost in national relations. Way before the United Nations came along, you know, it was the world of sport, the world of football, the world of cricket, the world of rugby that really almost made the world a smaller place in terms of getting an understanding between nations. Although you had this unifying game, it helped to show the differences as well. And those tours were so important for spreading the game, but also for sharing the game, sharing ideas. But yeah, to me, Corinthians are, I still long for a little bit of that ideal. In my naivety, I still long for that their very existence.
It's very much of its time, isn't it?
It is. Sadly, it is very much of its time, yeah.
I guess Queen's Park are the other great pioneer of those days, and obviously the first Scottish team, but played a similar role in many countries too, didn't they? So can't neglect them from their part in history. They just didn't get a massive Brazilian club named after them, unfortunately. So.
Queen's Park are a club that absolutely fascinate me. I read the Scotland chapter, but I think I've read the Scotland chapter three or four times because Queen's Park just fascinate me. They absolutely fascinate me. And again, I have a yearning for clubs like Queen's Park.
Well, Queen's Park, I mean, the legacy is huge. I mean, the one walk I recommend people do, actually, is if you're in Glasgow next year, your listeners are in Glasgow, you probably know it already. But if you're not, if you're first time you go to Glasgow, get a train south to Mount Florida. It's about three or four stops out of the city centre. And out there, you get out, kind of, follow the road round. You go past Queen's Park because obviously it started in a public park, and that is where they, you know, they invented passing, passing with feet, passing and moving, and is the sort of the modern way that we'd expect to play nowadays. But obviously in England, it was like more like rugby. It was just people just dribbling for themselves, but with their feet rather than their hands, and it was all a big scrum, and it wasn't very good. And it's Queen's Park that sort of educated the world how to pass. You know, they were not from public school background. They were kind of, I think, middle class men, and they sent off the rule book, and they took part in the early FA Cup. As you know, they donated all 11 members of the first Scotland team for the 1872 first international against England. And they donated the kit as well, which one of their members' sisters sewed the line rampant on as well. So they changed now. They're black and white hoops, as you probably know, but they were start out in blue, which quite conveniently is the colour of the Scottish flag as well. So if you walk out past Queen's Park, you then come past the Hampden Bowling Club, which sounds like a weird sort of venue. It's like, what's this? It's actually the world's first purpose-built international football stadium, or as was before they built a railway through it. So you can look over the railway, you can see a mural of Andrew Watson, the world's first black international footballer, who played for Scotland, captained Scotland actually, and three big wins, two over England and one over Wales. I think this is the 5-1, which is the one at that ground, the Hampden Bowling Club, as it's now, was, you know, the one 5-1, I think. And he's in the famous kind of yellow and pink, I can't remember his name, is it Robrey or something like that? He was one of the sort of sponsors of football. He has his racing colours. And then you can keep, so that's the first Hampden. You can follow up the road, go up to a place called Cathkin Park, which is an open space. It's now, was home of Third Lanark, and it was the second Hampden after the first one, obviously had the train built for it. But it's still there. You can see it's like concrete bowl on three quarters of the side in a public park where people walking their dogs and stuff. But the stands are still there, and you can still, we've got the barriers and stuff, and there's trees overgrown. It's wonderfully atmospheric. You keep going up, and then you come to actual Hampden, you know, current Hampden, which was the world's biggest football stadium for, 50 years until the Maracanã in 1950 World Cup. And it's... in the bowels of that stadium, you have the Scottish Football Museum, which I thoroughly recommend anyone goes to. But there's also Lesser Hampden, which is where Queen's Park play now. And like I said, I think they recently voted out of amateurism, but they were amateur for, you know, since the beginning until a couple of years ago. And fascinating club, huge legacy. Like I said, they introduced the game played the first demo match in Belfast. They played in Copenhagen. So they didn't get quite as far as Corinthians, but I guess that goes to show you how wealthy the Corinthians were, because they were playing like in South Africa, they were playing in like Scandinavia, they went to Hungary, they left cups and tournaments there, they went to North America, which I think we'll probably discuss shortly, in fact, because the North American tale itself was fascinating. But yeah, no, don't overlook Queen's Park. I know that you may see them come up on the final score on Saturday afternoon there, and you know, whichever league they are playing, Stenhouse Bureau or whoever, but it's like, they are, without them, you wouldn't have modern football, basically.
Well, you mentioned there North America, so let's mention them then. Right, Stephen, that's another interesting aspect of the book to me, not just North America, but I mean, Africa and Asia, you could probably throw into that too, of the development in places that I just knew next to little, next to nothing about. That sort of... Yeah, certain aspects, yes, as we talked about there, are vaguely familiar, even if we didn't know the depth of detail. But some of these stories are just completely new to me.
Same for me. These are parts of the world where I think, you know, even for people who think they're broad-minded about football will still, I don't know, kind of be less considered about almost. You know, we're talking about parts of the world that have hosted World Cups now, and we should know more about these parts of the world and how football grew there. You know, I know little bits and pieces about North America, but nowhere near the depth that Chris goes into. You know, it's been a wonderful education read about these. And these are parts of chapters that I was most looking forward to seeing, because, you know, got hold of the book and then, you know, you run your finger down the chapters and then you think, yes, what I want to read is that one, that one, that one. You know, you go through the whole book, it's brilliant. But yeah, you know, these were the ones where you're thinking, I mean, I learned something from every chapter, but you know, there were certain ones where you knew immediately on seeing them that there would be information here that I don't know. And these are just great chapters.
I was going to say the North American one was really interesting to research, actually, because if you think about the modern context, as you're saying, we've seen various attempts to sort of, and I think I start the North American chapter, there's lots of attempts to kickstart a soccer league there, but actually they had the first professional league outside of of UK and Ireland back in 1894 as an off-season baseball, a bit like the equivalent of here, where it was cricket teams who are like, what do we do over winter? Let's play football. Same over there. It's like, how do we make money? Oh, the baseball season's not on. Let's play soccer. And that's what they did. And actually, it was all up for grabs in the early 1900s. There was a lot of students dying playing American football in sort of pile-ups and scrums. And I think they had like 15 in a week or something ridiculous 1 week. And this is Ivy League school as well. So this is like people who've like influential kind of parents and stuff. And Teddy Roosevelt's son, I think, got injured. And there was this big summit about whether or not this game should be going on. And there was soccer in there growing. And it was good enough in North America that a Canadian team toured in 1888 in Britain and Ireland and did pretty well, beat some good teams. And so, yeah, it was quite strong. And then World War One actually acts as a, interestingly, between the US and Canada, because Canada was a Commonwealth country, obviously part of the empire, I guess, in those days, and then the US wasn't. So when the US enters World War One in 1917, they're mixing with football-playing countries where it's been established for generations, so French, British. And it acts like a catalyst almost for American game. And the converse is the case for Canada, where it's like there's quite a, you know, seen as the old country type thing. And they doesn't sort of catch on as well. Okay, in fact, it goes into decline. Whereas in the 1920s, the sort of first heyday of American soccer, the American Soccer League, which is absolutely like, I mean, it's not necessarily places that you would kind of expect, you know, that taking part in this. You know, they're not, I mean, here are some of the names here. Bohemian Queens, so obviously that's New York, I think. Hakko are all stars. It's a Jewish club. Hakko means strength. You know, it's a Hakko Avin in Vienna at the time that, you know, that Bela Gutman played for. Indiana Flooring Company. You can see there's an industrial connection. Providence Gold Bugs, Falco FC, Todd Shipyards. These are great names. Bethlehem Steel. And there's clubs, Vespa Buick, and there's also like Fall River has quite a few clubs. Fall River's in Maine, I think, up in the kind of far northeast, kind of Massachusetts kind of way. And it's just fascinating because that was attracting a lot of talent. And you see British press there comparing it to you know, Scottish second division and things like that. And you've got to be careful because these clubs have got money. It's America. It's in the 20s, obviously. So Britain's kind of recovering from the First World War. So it's a lot of the players kind of getting tempted by the money. And so by the time the US has a team to sail to the World Cup in 1930, I think about seven of them are Scottish, and the boss is Scottish, Robert Miller, and there's one Englishman, George Morehouse. And they make it all the way to the semi-finals. And so, you know, that's, you know, I know there's a weakened field if you think about the European teams that didn't go. There was no Wunder team from Austria, which I know you guys are fond of. There's no England, there's no Scotland. But still, you know, to reach the second semi-final, get the first hat-trick in the tournament. I mean, you know, they did pretty well. It was at the end, I guess the Wall Street crash came and kind of it went into decline. But it was, you know, had a brief golden period where it could have, you know, US could have done something. And that's, we only talk about the men's game, of course. The women's game thrived pretty well. They're obviously the best in the world and have been for a long time. So I want to make that point.
No, absolutely. And you're right there about the early pioneering World Cups and how the USA were far stronger there. It's so fascinating. I know this isn't quite the origins we're talking about there, but the way they dipped for, I don't know, half a century before their rise post-1990 is quite incredible. It's a fascinating topic, I guess, for another day, perhaps. Now, an area you get into in this, tracing the origins through certain key developmental events. Now, you mentioned in the international games, Olympics and so on are included here. There's also various national awakenings, such as like the tour of UK, Ireland and France of the team of black South Africans at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, the impact that had. Now, Stu, again, this is society and its impact or sports impact on society and vice versa. You know, it's you can't get much clearer indication of that, but it aids our understanding, I guess, of cultural norms at any given time, you know, to see how a touring team of black South Africans were perceived so long ago.
And I mean, it's it's strange because if you think of it now, and you say, you know, there's a team touring from South Africa. I mean, I can remember, you know, the apartheid in South Africa being banned and coming back for the Rugby World. You know, it's all within my, in fact, probably all our lifetimes, you know, that we can remember South Africa being banned from global sport. And yet now we're that, you know, time has sort of not softened the reasons, but it's softened the impact or the jarring impact that was of a touring South Africa team or a rebel tour to South Africa and all the connotations that went with that. Certainly, like I say, in my childhood and in my formative years for sport. But now it's become, you know, yep, South Africa touring, or yep, this summer it's South Africa playing cricket. And it's very much, like we say, of its time. But you go back to, you know, when Chris writes, and, you know, you think of a touring South African team, and, you know, the first thing you think of is, what was South African politics actually like sort of back then? So that's the first thing you think. And then when you think of it, you know, it's a black team touring, and part of you thinks, well, how did that happen? You know, how was that even allowed to happen? But then again, what it, and Steve mentioned it as well, when you open the book and you go down the chapters, and there's some that you, you know, I love books that you can bounce around the chapters out of order. You know, and South Africa is one for me. And when you know, the sheer comprehension of a black touring South Africa team, but the really, not the difficult bit is, but like you just said there, Aidan, it's the context it sits in. So my context of South Africa is now one of acceptability and normality, but I can relate to when it wasn't acceptable, it wasn't normal, and South Africa weren't involved. And the reasons for that, you then have to take all of that context and apply it sort of almost 100 years ago. And it becomes really difficult to sort of legitimize it all and understand its place in the game until you read Chris's book. And, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, Aidan, the sheer amount of depth of research and detail that's gone into it. And this is why the book really works, because it's not just a skimming of the surface of these, you know, it's not a passive, what I would call a passive history. It's a detailed history where you see the chapter, you read bits, and you think, how did that happen? But it doesn't matter, because two or three pages down the line, you get all the answers you're ever going to need. And that's the beauty of this book. But yeah, the concept of South Africa touring at the turn of the century is one thing. The concept of a black South African side touring just jars, because of your assumptions of its time, not because of where we sit now, but because the context of its time.
The context of its time, unfortunately, was firstly, just for context, it wasn't known as South Africa at that point. It's like the Cape Colony, and they were from the Free State, Orange Free State. It was put together by a guy from the Welsh FA and someone from the Orange Free State. And it was very much, unfortunately, it wasn't a meeting of sporting equals. It was more of a kind of entertainment for the public type thing. And that's because they would never have been able to have interracial matches anyway within South Africa, because of the way it was totally racially kind of divided. So when they came to the UK and they played, like, I think it was like 26 odd match, I think it was, and they did everywhere. They went to England, they Scotland, they went to Belfast, they even did one match in France, which is the only game they won. But still, it wouldn't have been something that the public would have seen before necessarily. And it's, again, the language of the time, I haven't put it in the book because I didn't obviously want that language in my book. But it's not favorable, should we say. It's like, you know, they are objectified, I should say, rather than, you know, rather than it being a meeting of sporting equals, I think it's the way it's described. But that was a fascinating chapter in itself. Within the, I think that was quite an issue. The whole Africa and Middle East chapter itself is quite indicative of, it's more tied to colonialism than possibly any of the other chapters. So if you go north up to Egypt, where football gets in early, and they're like the first African team to appear in the international tournament, I think in the 1920 or 24 Olympics, and the first, you know, first Egyptian plays at Dulwich Hamlet in 1910, Hussein Hegazi, or 1912, and he goes on to become national coach. It's the team that's still, like, you know, again, Africa's team of the century, which is Al Ahly, who from Cairo, who kind of emerged in 1907 as the sort of nationalist team, especially after World War One, which is a big catalyst in for football and national awakening in Egypt in general. You actually see that, and likewise in Turkey, where the Ottoman Empire collapses with defeat, the British and French occupy Turkey, and this kind of proxy war is played out on the football pitch between English and French teams and Turkish teams, and Fenerbahce, who, which interesting in English means the lighthouse garden, by the way, just in case anyone's interested. They kind of beat the sort of the British team that's leaving. This guy called Harrington, who puts a trophy up for grabs, which is in the Fenerbahce Museum now, called the Harrington Cup. And it's like whoever wins this match, he wanted to send you know, give a big send off, and he has a former Chelsea player in there and stuff like that. And but it doesn't happen. Fenerbahce win. And so it's all like you see all the way through this, whether it's in South Africa, it's sort of linked to race, whether it's kind of in Egypt, it's linked to colonialism and having been being able to sort of beat the occupier. Likewise in Turkey. And also you see it in India as well in 1911, it's a different chapter, the Asia chapter, but still. The East Mohun Bagan, who's one of the biggest teams now, even in India, they win the IFI Shield, the Indian Football Association Shield, in 1911, and it's a massive moment in the sort of independence movement. So it means sort of gives them a lot of self belief again, just before World War One, and you can see things kind of British grip on India weakens after World War Two anyway. And that's obviously not just down to that one match, but it's, you know, it's kind of gives a bit of impetus. And interestingly, Gandhi himself was in South Africa in the early 1900s and was involved in Indian community football there as well. Just while we're on that chapter.
Fabulous stuff. Now, one of the other recurring themes, I guess, throughout, in fact, you end each chapter with this, I think, is some of the original clubs and where are they now kind of thing. And one that sticks out as completely jarring as, you know, the anomaly in amongst all of this to me is Genoa. Stephen, this is bizarre, isn't it? Usually all these founding clubs, they've gone by the wayside, you know, economic factors or the fact that they were just so small as to be, you know, unsustainable in the big, beastly professional world. But Genoa, they stick out like a sore thumb as the obvious difference there, don't they? And does that give them, I don't know, some kind of added credence or allure? I know we've talked at length about Sampdoria from that city.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, a lot of people won't realise that Sampdoria are traditionally the poorer relatives in the city of Genoa. You know, Genoa, what, 8-9 times Italian champions. You know, a lot of glory in the past. They are that anomaly. You know, you look at Italian football and Provincelli being this omnipresent early figure that just vanishes. And we did a podcast about them on the End of an Era series, I think with Matthew Gibbs, possibly. Sorry if I got that wrong. But you know, it was fascinating talking about them because there's this ethereal kind of, I don't know, aura about teams like that that were just so important in an era, especially formative eras, to fall away. And in some cases vanish. But then here you've got Genoa, who are still, you know, an omnipresent figure in the very top flight of Italian football and have been. They've been part of that football Italia era. You know, they have a kit that's nearly is pretty evocative in its own right. You know, we talk about how you know, legendary and evocative the Sampdoria kit is, but that Genoa on something special. And, you know, they are, you know, one of the great early purveyors. They remain kind of like a yardstick for people who look back across the span of football and deeper into the history. And there'll be plenty of people out there, and it's no shame in not knowing the where they've come from and what they were and, you know, just how significant of a football club that they are. And they are one of the, you know, they're utterly fascinating. And people talk about Italian football and the greats, and obviously you've got, you know, the Turin and the Milan Giants, but there's so much more depth to the Italian game, and it kind of begins, you know, with Genoa alongside Provincelli, and here they still are, and that's, you know, such an unusual thing, and it makes them an exceptionally special football club.
Now, it is an unusual thing, you're right. And now, Chris, on this theme, there's been various attempts successes of reviving some of these original clubs in new form. Now, the Wanderers, we mentioned them as the original FA Cup winners. Now, they're back in existence. Similarly, I think you mentioned Fall River, that those clubs there have been revived. Now, is the importance of their history enhanced by their revival, do you think? And secondly, a follow-up to that, of the clubs you've covered in this book that pioneered the game but no longer exist, which one would you revive?
Well, here's the thing. It's very interesting, as you mentioned, Genoa still in the top flight. Very few of them are actually still in the top flight of their, or prominent in their countries. I'm trying to think, very, you know, St. Gallen in Switzerland, it's a pioneer club. Royal Antwerp won the cup a couple of years ago. They're still prominent. I guess you're also looking at Sparta and Slavia Prague, which is possibly the oldest cross-city derby in the world outside the UK and Ireland. Quilmes in Argentina, which is was part of the second edition of the league. They're still going. So there's most of them are not at the top of their game still. But as you mentioned, there is this kind of revivalism going on. So people are rediscovering it. It's become very, popular thing to do. But it's great to see that, especially when a club has been shut down tragically. So DFC Prague, for example, which Deutsche Fußball Club Prague, which was formed I can't remember, it was a cusp of the turn of the 1900s, whatever, and they were in the very first German championship final. They lost to VfL Leipzig 1903 up at Altona's ground in Hamburg. They were obviously closed. They were a Jewish club, and they were closed down by the Nazis, or they think they voluntarily closed down. I can't remember exactly, in like 1940 or maybe 38, when Czechoslovakia was kind of taken over. Anyway, they got refounded recently, which is great. And there seems to be a bigger interest in this. And just want to give a quick shout out to the Egri Erbstein tournament, which you guys might have been followed. If you're not, look out for that. It's in July next year. And basically it's held at Corinthian Casuals, which is Corinthians' team nowadays. And they've got Budapest Etikai Club, who's a club that was the Erbstein played for, again, refounded recently because of the Erbstein biography by Dominic Bliss. He kind of inspired their refounding. And also Fall River Marksmen are attending that, as is Sheffield FC as well. So you've got all these pioneering clubs, two of which have been refounded, and they're going to be sort of appearing. That's really great news. So yeah, and Wanderers have as well been refounded recently as well. But if there were a club that I would like to, one of the fascinating clubs that came across was White Rovers of Paris, who only existed for a very short period of time in the 1890s. And they kind of finished runners up in the early French league about three or four times and then disappear. And I just love the name. I like the sort of the idea that these clubs exist and disappeared, and you only really find out about them really digging through the archive. But other ones, I think the biggest loss really is Blackburn Olympic, which only existed for 12 years. It was killed off by a kind of professionalism, got really kind of, I guess, overshadowed by Blackburn Rovers in the professional era, crosstown rival. And, there's been very little kind of mark of them left really anywhere, I understand, Blackburn. And yet here they are, they're the ones who won, you know, upset the order, won the FA Cup from the upper class guys. And it never returned again to the sort of the public school influence. So yeah, I'm just fascinated by these kind of lost clubs, and it's great to see so many being refounded.
Well, we look forward to the day when you revive Blackburn Olympic there, Chris. As you say, possibly the most influential in the expansion of the professional game, I suppose, you know, the way it changed. One of the key drivers in that. Well, final question for you, Stu. I mentioned no test, but, you know, can you please tell me where Corinthians toured in 1902?
I did revise this, but I kept getting it mixed up with 04 and 06.
Oh, yeah, it's easily done.
It was a tricky one. I looked for the acronym that would help me remember, but I just couldn't.
Sorry about that. Couldn't resist. Anyway, before we wrap things up, I mentioned earlier that the book Origin Stories. It was released earlier this year in the spring, as Chris mentioned before. So there's no need for anyone to wait. It's out there and available right now, and heartily recommended it is. So how's the book been going, Chris? And how have you found the whole experience of being a published author?
Well, I think we're pretty much all out on pitch, aren't we? So you guys know probably more than me. But yeah, no, it's interesting. It's a bit frustrating because obviously it's during lockdown and stuff. So I wasn't able to do a like proper book launch or anything like that. Because if you've got a geek in your family, you want this book, and it's kind of, you're never struggling in a pub quiz again. And I was going to do a pub quiz. I thought, oh, great, launch it with a pub quiz and see how many people, you know, can answer it. But that wasn't possible. Yeah, no, it's been, a very big learning, because I'm working on a second one, which I'm going to keep it under wraps just for now. But people know more about in the coming months. And that has just flown by because of the learnings from this first one in terms of, you know, making connections, in terms of understanding how to put it together from a kind of book writing point of view. Do you know what I mean? A creative kind of process point of view. And and just not make it as long as I know it's 380 something pages. I actually cut out about 12,000 words. I don't know what to do with it. I've just put some blog posts up, I guess, at some point. But it's probably the wrong book to start with, to be honest, if you know what I mean. It's just took a lot of research, 4 years.
That's it, a labour of love, isn't it? And as Stephen, as you've always said, one book leads into another.
It does. You know, once you've done it once, then it becomes a bit of an incurable itch. And that's no bad thing.
Absolutely. And Stuart, it's the passion of the writer's connection to a subject. You know, Chris saying this took 4 years of work and research. You know, maybe you've refined the technique a bit now, Chris, but that sort of shows the sort of dedication to the subject matter that, and it's that passion that drives us to write what we write, I guess, and put the time and effort in to write the books that we'd like to read. And this is no exception, is it?
That's exactly it. And those were the words that Stephen gave me when I happened to mention to him one night that I might be thinking about writing a book. And before we'd finished the conversation, I had the pictures, the front cover, the lot, which was of no real help, although he thought he was helping, just put more pressure on. But yeah, he said to me, you can only write the book that you would want to read. And then hopefully there will be at least one other person who might want to read it. And that's it. That is all you can do. And if there's one other person, then you've absolutely cracked it. But yeah, Chris's book is, like I said, it couldn't be a passive sort of glance at the history and the origins of football. It's one of those books where if it's going to be done, it's got to be done properly. But if it's done properly, it only ever needs doing once. And that's the great thing about Chris's book. You know, it's been done. It's been done brilliantly. So this is the book. It becomes the definitive book straight away. And to do that on a first attempt is pretty impressive. Although I've got a sneaky suspicion that your new book is actually How All We Know About Football Was Learned from Terminator 2. I'm pretty sure that's what your book is. I know you keep it a secret, but
well, I'll disclose some of it. I mean, it's actually going to be about football and politics. I won't go into any more than that because the whole thing everyone tries to distinguish the two, and we don't want to.
We know a man who will be very, very interested in this book.
Oh
yes,
yeah, I was going to say yeah.
If football and politics didn't mix, we'd have had nothing to talk about so many times.
Well, I was going to say, as I say in my book, it's like almost from the off. Probably Ireland, I think, is the first place that football got political, because that's when it was part of the sort of the nationalist movement. It was very much about protecting the Gaelic games from British imports of English football, rugby and cricket. So I touch on that, and that's chapter 4. So you talk about 1880s, so yeah, football's been pretty much political from the off.
Indeed it has.
Absolutely, absolutely. Indeed. And it will continue to be, so I'm quite sure. So a rich subject for you to get into there, I'm sure. So we'll get you back on in future as and when that one is out. Well, cool. We'll wrap things up there. So thanks, Stu and Stephen, for both your contributions tonight. Another fascinating chat.
Yeah, the joy as always.
Brilliant. Loved it.
So Origin Stories, Pioneers Who Took Football to the World, that's the title. We can heartily recommend it to anyone with a sense of football history, its place in society and beyond. I should add, Chris's podcast, Outside Right, is a treasure trove of information and discussion about football around the world, past and present. So I urge our listeners to go and check that one out too. But thank you very much, Chris, for coming on to talk all about this book. Really fascinating subject.
No, thank you. And keep up the great content, you guys.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And thank you to everyone for listening. And do join us again on the Lob podcast from These Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.